Hey everyone, this is Space Cafe Podcast, and I am Marcus. I recently came across an interesting story that I would like to share because it's a wonderful example of how relative and fluid our worldviews are. Before we get started, though, to all my American friends, because I feel like you're very sensitive about topics like this, please skip the next 10 seconds if you're offended by small male anatomies. So, the story takes us back to antiquity and the observation that archaic heroes or gods like Hercules, Zeus, or some of Michelangelo's sculptures were depicted with surprisingly small penises compared to their body sizes. Historians provide an equally surprising answer to this. Only grotesque, foolish men ruled by lust and sex drive had large penises in ancient Greece. The ideal Greek man was rational, intellectual, and authoritarian. He may have had a lot of sex, but that had nothing to do with his penis size, and his small penis allowed him to remain cool and logical. I just allow myself to keep it that way and not jump to conclusions, but it's a good segue into our topic today. We will not deal with genitals, but with human artifacts and their change of meaning through space and time. Because, as we will see in a moment, the worldview we think is immutable is an illusion. The foundation for this assertion is provided by none other than my guest today, space archaeologist Alice Gorman. From a very young age, she wanted to be an astrophysicist and an archaeologist, so she decided to lump the two together and make a new discipline out of it. Alice lives and does research in Australia and was kind enough to get up very early for this interview.
In that case, I will make a coffee super quickly, if that's okay.
Based at Flinders University in Adelaide, Alice is an expert in indigenous stone tool analysis, but better known for her research into the archaeology of orbital debris, terrestrial launch sites, and satellite tracking stations. Here we go. What's the oldest archaeological site you can think of on Earth?
The oldest archaeological site on Earth is called Lomekwe. It's in northern Africa. I think it's actually in Ethiopia, that general geographic region, and 3.3 million years old. And a number of stone tools have been found there, but we don't actually know which kind of human or human ancestor made these stone tools. So that's the oldest one I can think of.
Is that sort of related to the Lucy site?
Yes, I think general geographic area, but very different locations.
Okay.
And the thing about Lucy is, of course, we actually have parts of Lucy's body, and at Lomekwe, all we have is some stone tools. So it's a bit mysterious.
Of course, it's mysterious, but it's very clearly human tools, or is it humanoid? How would you call them? Because we're not talking about Homo sapiens yet, of course.
Absolutely not. So this would be a hominid. So this is someone in our ancestral line, but definitely not Homo sapiens. More likely, so Lucy is Australopithecus afarensis. So we're sort of talking ancestral, but definitely not Homo species.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. When does something become archaeological? Does it have to be dead?
That's a really interesting question. So traditionally, we would say yes, This is stuff in the past that we want to ask questions about, and the reason we're using archaeological methods is because there is no one alive to ask. There's no written or documentary record to ask, not that those are necessarily accurate representations of what happened in the past. They're artifacts in their own right as well. And the remains that we're looking at have ceased to be used. You know, they're discarded, they're rubbish. So this is the thing that makes this archaeology, that we're using a particular suite of scientific methods to try and get from those objects and places and contexts what was actually happening in people's minds. But the closer you bring this to the present, so there's a whole archaeological discipline called historical archaeology, and this is about what happens when European nations go to indigenous nations and colonize them. So historical archaeology kind of looks at that process in terms of sort of globalization and the growth of mercantile capitalism and a whole bunch of stuff, and of course the impacts on indigenous people, who again, like, so we have heaps of records from those times, but we often don't have the voices of enslaved people or indigenous people, and archaeology provides that side of the story. And getting even closer to the present, there's also industrial archaeology, which kind of looks industrial revolution on at the all of the, you know, the machines and the processes that lead to mass manufacture. So, again, then you start to edge into a time where people are alive, and then we get the archaeology of the contemporary past, which space archaeology is part of. And in this instance, the things are far from dead. The people are around, and the places and the objects are often actually being used.
So the overarching element that holds everything together is that we're talking about human artifacts when we talk about archaeology. So it must be of human origin, right?
This is true, Marcus. So there are other kinds of archaeology that look at what might be potentially alien artifacts. Xenoarchaeology is often the term used. So we're very much focusing on human artifacts. And in fact, the point you're making here is the key one also. It doesn't matter if these artifacts are in use or the people are alive or dead. It's their materiality. It's all about that human engagement with the material world, whether that's other human manufactured things or whether that's just the sort of the natural environment, as we might call it. So that's kind of the core of what archaeology is. And with space archaeology, we're basically doing the same thing. It just happens to be in this very different location.
Fascinating. Let's go into space. We have enough human artifacts on Earth, of course. So you decided to focus your work, your professional work on space archaeology. That sounds a little strange at first glance. What is space archaeology? Because we are talking about human remnants. So we haven't been around in space for such a long time. So what is space archaeology in the first place?
So like all those these artifacts we've just been talking about, which we're using as windows into past human worlds, space archaeology is pretty much the same thing, but we're looking at all of the places and artifacts that are related to the human movement into space. And I guess in this case, because of course we do have access to the people who worked on these projects and, you know, all of the records that go with those. So what we're actually interested in is what the objects can tell us that we don't find in all of those records, or that talking to people can't help us find. And I guess that's kind of like large-scale patterns, or the things that the way an object might have been designed in response to social or political factors. And I guess unlike other kinds of archaeology, like we are edging into the future. And I think one of the things that makes the archaeological study of this stuff important now. So it's not just curiosity, although there's plenty of fascinating questions to answer. It's also, to my way of thinking, like we're right now, we're in a period of like crazy development in space. There's so much going on. Mm-hmm. Going to the moon, mm-hmm. going to Mars, all of these discussions of how human society might change. And looking at how those material things shape our behavior around space and how they reflect ideologies of different kinds, I actually think is critical information. It's like another strand of things that we need to know if we're going to make good decisions as we go out further into the solar system. And of course, the other thing here is the deep time perspective as well. So trying to place what humans are doing now on other lands, maybe the easy way to understand this is to say, well, we have the archaeological record of when different human groups arrived in different locations, like the move from Africa to Europe or the Middle East or the subcontinent. Like, we have those archaeological records. What can we say about how humans adapt to different environments when we place it in this much broader context? And I want to very strongly say I'm not a fan of colonial narratives in the space world. I think they're misused very badly. But I also think that archaeology gives us a perspective that's more than just what happened since the launch of Sputnik 1, that I think is really useful. And I think there are a lot of ways. I mean, archaeology is always political in a sense. So some of the criticisms of archaeology as a discipline are that it tends to support those in power, the narratives that are created from archaeology can be co-opted by those in power and those who want to keep control of their own narratives. And we would counter that by saying, well, we have the capacity to tell the story of those who have been suppressed because the artifacts tell a different story. So there's kind of a contrast in uses there. But when we're looking at this really contemporary stuff, there are a lot, like the space world does have this big colonial narrative. And if you look at the archaeological underpinnings of that, then, we can say, actually, it's not what you think it is. And we can play a part in shaping new narratives about space that are maybe going to help us avoid the mistakes of the past. So, it's such a common expression. We need to learn from the mistakes of the past. Well, what exactly were they? What happened in the past? Somewhere along the line, you're going to need archaeological evidence to kind of say that. So I think there's a lot of relevance just to asking questions and to looking at not what people say is going on, but what is actually going on as evidenced by the physical remains.
Mm-hmm. Let's board an imaginary spaceship and go to a place of your choice in space. And let's talk about a very concrete artifact that you're free to choose, of course. And let's talk about space archaeology and why it is important using and focusing on that very artifact. So why don't you take us by the hand here?
So there are so many places that I could choose for this, but I'm going to look at one of my favorites. So let's think about the Venera 14 landing craft on Venus. So this is a Russian program of Venus exploration that took place throughout the 60s, 70s and 80s. And because the focus of the space race and the interest in what the USSR and the US were doing around the moon. People often forget that Russia had been launching things towards Venus since 1961, so really, really early in this process. And I choose Venera 14, I guess, because it was one of the most successful of the Venera series, and it sent back data, I think, for about 90 minutes after it landed on the surface. And the reason I think it's interesting to think about Venera 14 and its precursors is because the physical form of Venera 14 reflected a sort of a feedback loop of learning about what Venus was like. So the spacecraft, when the first Venera spacecraft were launched, it was absolutely unknown what the surface of Venus was like. I mean, there were theories, obviously, but these theories varied widely. And one thing that wasn't known was what the atmospheric pressure was. So the early Venera craft were basically crushed as they descended through the atmosphere. So each iteration of the landing craft had to respond to the information derived from the previous ones. So when you, by the time you get to Venera 14 and 13, they were launched in similar times with similar missions. That kind of feedback, design feedback, had reached a successful conclusion. So you look at the Venera 14, not just as the object itself and what it looks like. For Doctor Who fans, I often say it looks like a Dalek. So it's quite tall. It's probably the height of a room. I don't think Daleks are that big, but it has a sort of a roughly I can't think of the word to describe this. Its core is a titanium sphere. So by that time they were using titanium because of its high temperature, melting temperature, because it's very strong. It has sort of a little skirt at the bottom, and it has a kind of a pointy head. So it's also kind of anthropomorphic, like you look at it and it feels like a schematic sort of human figure. In fact, I've never thought to compare it to a Venus of Willendorf, but there are some similarities. This is an interesting thought.
Very interesting.
So we're looking at an object.
So why do you think the Russians chose a human form, consciously or unconsciously?
I think it was, as you say, it would have been very much unconscious. But there's a really interesting phenomenon around spacecraft. So we see it particularly with surface rovers on Mars and the moon also a little bit. Like people love to imbue them with human qualities and think of them as actual personalities. And a lot of people in the space world will just say, oh, look, don't be ridiculous. It's stupid to do that. You know, they're inanimate, they're machines. This is just us reading our own emotions into them. So you will hear a lot of people being quite opposed to people doing that. On the other hand, you might remember the European Space Agency's Rosetta and Philae campaign, where they actively encouraged us to do that. And I love that. I loved it. And I think there is something. I mean, you raise a really interesting point. They would not have intended to design the Venera landing craft to have any kind of resemblance to human figures, let alone Daleks. But it is being able to interpret personality into a robot, effectively, based on its physical form. It turns out this is actually quite an important part of the social world, the social and symbolic world that space people live in. And I do find it interesting when I talk to aerospace engineers and suggest that there are symbolic and social dimensions to the hardware that they're building, sometimes I get really positive reactions, like engineers who, they loved their spacecraft, they loved the projects they were working on, and they're very happy to have the opportunity to think and talk more about their projects in different ways. But others sometimes are extremely annoyed that you are interpreting something beyond pure technology into their instruments. That's not part of how they think about them at all. And yet that stuff is there. In fact, I did at one point try to investigate whether the BBC or the people working for the BBC, and Doctor Who fans will know all of these details, I don't know them off the top of my head, whether they were influenced by Russian spacecraft design when they built the Sputniks. That would have been, not the Sputniks, the Daleks. That would have been unconscious as well, and I certainly couldn't find any records of it. But the resonances with USSR spacecraft design, not just the Veneras but others as well, is kind of quite remarkable to me. So, I mean, there are lots of, I suppose this brings us to another interesting question or thing to consider, which is that the sort of entanglement of space design and everyday design. So we tend to separate these modes of operation. We tend to think, well, the stuff's out there on a planet, on another planet doing its thing. It doesn't have any influence on what's happening on Earth. But then you look at, you know, a very common rationale for space exploration is for people to say, sure, we're spending huge sums of money to send people into orbit, but what are the spin-offs? We get all these benefits back on Earth in all these different technological things. And that's certainly a part of the story. But then there's all this everyday stuff as well, like how much are, and I haven't investigated this yet, but what are the, it's not just us designing a thing we send to another planet. How does that relate to everything that's designed on Earth? And do we actually, maybe we can't pick them out because they're too entangled, but would we see resonances of rovers that are used in terrestrial, maybe industrial settings? What are the common design features of all of these robots? What makes the space ones? Well, we know obviously the space ones have to have particular characteristics or they're not going to work on those other planets. But something I've become more and more interested in lately is what things remain unchanged, what Earth objects change in no way at all if we send them into space. And I'm very sorry, Marcus, I'm going to bring up my current obsession, which is the Ziploc bag, the little plastic bag with the seal on the top that we call a snaplock or a Ziploc bag. Thousands of them are used on the International Space Station, and they are exactly the same as the ones you or I might have in our kitchen, exactly the same. So don't you think that's extraordinary? A little piece of plastic that we can use in Earth or in microgravity or maybe one day in Mars in identical form. Nothing about it has to change to go into space. So I think there's a whole lot of interesting stuff to be done. Like Elon Musk has talked about becoming a multi-planetary species. And I have thoughts about that. I won't go into that now. But I think in terms of human adaptation, one of the key things is if humans are going to keep living off Earth, we actually have to become a multi-gravity species because gravity is the limiting factor on what human bodies can do. So I think it's really interesting in terms of the objects and materials that we might use when we're off Earth to investigate further what stays the same, what has to change, what's different. And so it's really interesting for me to think about...
What's your role in all of this? So if you were asked to jump on board preparing or helping prepare future interplanetary missions, why would people want to listen to you and your expertise as a space archaeologist?
So much to think about in response to that question. So... one of the things I'm working on at the moment is an archaeological study of the International Space Station with my colleague Justin Walsh from Chapman University in the US. And we're hoping to find patterns of behaviour that no one has noticed yet because they haven't done it from an archaeological perspective. Two of our early results show that sticking pictures on the walls of the International Space Station, which we often see if you look at images or videos of the ISS, you will often see pictures on the walls. But we've actually mapped how they change over time, particularly in the Russian Zvezda module, and shown that they relate, how they change over time relates very strongly to political events in Russia. And we've been investigating how these images help create social cohesion and help people feel connected. So that's just kind of a simple thing, because it doesn't take much to imagine how like fridge magnets, the things you stick on the walls and can see as you go about your work, how they might have an impact on your daily life. But, you know, we can definitively say if you were designing a new space habitat somewhere, then you might want to think about how the walls and spaces you design might be used to do this. Another of our results has been to look at the gendered use of space in the International Space Station. Now, this is a little bit tricky because by far the most crew, men have been most of the crew most of the time. It's only 11.5% of all the people who have ever been into space have been women. But nonetheless, we're seeing some patterns emerge. So it seems that even the limited number of women who've had a chance to live and work on the ISS spend more time in the cupola than they do, than do the men. So here's an interesting question. So what causes that difference? Is it something we can make a recommendation about that might help future habitat design? So these are just a few of the early results coming from this project. But there's other things as well. So from an archaeological perspective, we can see how settlement designs and house designs have changed over the long course of human existence, and how some of them map onto different family structures and social forms. So in the contemporary Western industrial world, we're kind of quite used to the idea of the nuclear family as sort of a social unit and an economic unit. But in fact, the nuclear family is relatively recent. And for most of human history, it's been different kinds of structure, and they have often had different architectures. These architectures have involved maybe separating people into age or gender classes, and you sleep and work in a building with other people of your age and class, not with a mother, father, da-da-da-da. Now, it's quite possible that in the future space societies might find it more practical to adopt some of these different social forms. And what we can say is, well, here are the architectures that go with them, and then what are the implications of this? So we've got working from a physical building to understanding how people are actually genetically related to each other and socially related to each other. So maybe in future space settlements, a genetic relationship is not the most effective social bond. Maybe the most effective social bond is cutting across those to maybe age classes or something like that. And there's plenty of science fiction. Science fiction writers often actually explore these issues in ways that are far more interesting than you know, the people who are paid to do this stuff for a job. So how would we design a settlement that would accommodate a social structure that is not based around the standard nuclear family? And how might we design? And, of course, this is a huge question, like chicken and eggs, which influences which? If you grow up in a certain settlement form, architectural form, are you more likely to follow a certain pattern of interaction and kinship with other people, or do you subvert that? Do you break out of that? And in fact, that's the other thing archaeologists can tell. So I'll use the example here of the Woomera village, which is associated with, was built to for all of the people working at the Woomera launch range in South Australia to live on. And this was a place designed to promote social harmony and well-being. And they did that by having streets that weren't through streets. So people lived on their own street and there was never, you didn't go through the street to get anywhere. And the idea was that you would form bonds with your neighbours. Now that seems to have happened. But what also happened is that people went off the beaten track and created their own paths, ghost tracks or ghost lines. And you can see what they did. We can see what the roads said they ought to be doing, but we can also see the informal, the subverted architecture of what they actually did. So there's two sides to this. Like, can we draw on examples from the archaeological past to try and understand how society and infrastructure mutually create a certain kind of way of living? And do we also look at it to see, well, what happens if you use that? Where are the weak points? What breaks out? What are the risks and the dangers of structuring things a certain way? And of course, the other example people like to use is the whole collapse of civilization thing. So they're saying, you know, we'll have that on Earth. So we start afresh in space. But what do you do? And I'll also say here, I don't like these metaphors much either, but I'm bringing them up because I know people talk about them. So how do you present a collapse of civilization on Mars? So we have plenty of precedents on Earth to try and understand how that happened. I won't talk about them because this is not really my area of specialization, but this is another thing that kind of draws archaeological knowledge into how we might make decisions about what happens in space. So I hope this is a convincing case to consider archaeology as an essential feature.
It is indeed. It's fascinating, and I'm wondering, is anyone listening out there? I mean, like, if take for example Elon's Starship. So when he's designing a Starship for, I don't know, 120 passengers, is he calling you up to help him design the proper Starship shape according to all those gender balance and female and male preferences and whatnot? Or are we still in a stage where our society focuses on thruster design and the proper hull design and whatnot, and is not yet ready to take a closer look at human needs?
Well, Marcus, the sad reality is Elon Musk is never going to ring me up, because I suggested that when he sent the Tesla sports car into space, that this was the equivalent of a dick pic and symbolized his relationship to masculinity. So that man is never going to call me. But it's an interesting question. So NASA, for example, in its specifications for people who can apply to be astronauts, explicitly says they don't want archaeologists or anthropologists or other social sciences. So I think at the moment, we are on my International Space Station archaeological project with Justin Walsh. We are working quite closely with NASA, although not the people who are involved in astronaut selection, obviously. So there's definitely some interest there. And we may have a chance to you know, have some kind of influence on how future space habitats are designed. But in general, I would say it's difficult to get the ear of an aerospace engineer or designer. And I guess part of it's, as we alluded to at the beginning, is saying, well, how does space and archaeology go together? I don't get this. So it does require a lot of setting up and explanation. But I also think in just maybe the last 5 years, there's always been people who have been working on the social and symbolic aspects of how we relate to space. But maybe just in the last 5 years, there's been a critical mass of such people. And I think we are starting to get heard more. So it's still an uphill battle because we're kind of talking about the age-old rivalry or the age-old division between STEM fields and humanities and social sciences. And those are hard bridges to cross. But things like, Spacewatch Global and the Space Cafe are doing an amazing job of actually crossing some of those bridges, which I think is so important.
Wonderful.
So I think we're going to see more of this. I think it's becoming easier mm-hmm. to have these conversations mm-hmm. and have people say, oh, okay, not say, look, go away. You're talking about symbolism in space. Mm-hmm. I don't want to hear. But to say, okay, tell me a bit mm-hmm. more. I'm interested in this.
Sure,
so
sure.
I think we're going to have more influence in the future.
Let's go back to the discussion about the human artifacts. I was wondering if you take, for example, the famous poop bags of the Apollo missions, and I suspect they're still lying around on the moon. On Earth, you would be punished for throwing stuff like that out into the open. On the moon, it's worth a lot of perhaps also money, if you would want to make that comparison. So the question is, at what point is something rubbish and at what point is it an artifact?
The question of what's rubbish and what's archaeology, of course, comes to a head when we're in the present. So in the past, it's easy. Everything is an artifact. And in fact, what we study is things people discard. Rubbish dumps are heaven for an archaeologist. But as we get into the present, those distinctions are not so clear-cut. And, of course, we do have now a global sensibility of being responsible for the environment, which involves us not discarding things. So my view on this, I have had discussions with people and they say, well, all of the things the Apollo missions left behind on the moon are litter and we should get rid of them. Obviously, I disagree because I want to study them, and I also think those poop bags, we will get an understanding of what happens when human biological material, sure, it's in a bag, is exposed to the lunar environment for that length of time. So there's critical information, mm-hmm. scientific mm-hmm. information in those poop bags. But the fact that they exist, it tells us a whole bunch of things. It tells us something about the waste management processes of those early space missions. And to be honest with you, this is still a big issue in space missions. So we have not solved pooping in space in a good way, even now. So this is part of a trajectory of technology which takes us to the International Space Station and on to the Lunar Gateway and on to other possible planetary settlements, how waste management has evolved in different gravitational situations. So we learn that from it as well. We also learn, and we're kind of in the middle of this at the moment, so it's hard to know which way it will go, but we also learn something about attitudes to the moon. So the attitude basically that allowed all of that stuff to be discarded and left there, okay, there was a practical aspect as well. They had to get rid of weight so the ascent module could take off. So it's not all about this. There are some practical things as well. But the attitude to the moon is that there's nothing alive there. It has no ecosystem. No harm can be caused to it. The moon is dead. I don't think the moon is dead, and we're getting more and more evidence with scientific studies that the moon is a very active place. So for how long is it? 1959, the first human object, Luna 2, collides with the moon, right up till maybe just the last few years. What we leave on the surface of the moon reflects an attitude that no environmental harm will come from human materials on the moon. But there's a shift of thinking now. More and more people are saying we shouldn't be trashing other planets. This is litter and we shouldn't be leaving it. So future missions to the moon are going to have to account for this to the public. And people say to me sometimes, but, oh, won't that upset you? There'll be no archaeology. But that's actually not the case, because what happens is the archaeology, and it will reflect a change in how people think about the moon. So they will have to have better waste management systems. They will have to have processes in place to not cause irreversible harm to the lunar environment, and this will be reflected in the technology. So from an archaeologist's perspective, what we will be able to track that change in thinking about our relationship to the moon through the stuff that's left on the surface, even if that's becomes less chaotic and disorderly and there's no more poop bags lying on the surface. So that is part of the question and the study in itself.
Mm-hmm. How do you deal with the current issue that is growing in Earth orbit when it comes to space debris? How should we deal with that? Because, I mean, like, this is a huge space trash dump. And so the question is, you mentioned it's heaven for archaeologists, but it's hell for spacefarers. So who wins?
Well, this is a wonderful question because everybody wins. So the way I think about this, because my background is in cultural heritage management on Earth, in which I was often doing projects as part of large environmental impact studies. So I would often be out in the field with all of the people studying the dust and the noise and the flora and the fauna, and we'd all be contributing to a huge document generally, environmental impact study. And this is kind of how I think about space junk as well. So there have as yet been no environmental impact studies for space operations in orbit because people don't think there's an environment there. They think because it's not a biological environment, it doesn't count as an environment. But obviously it is an environment. I mean, we even have weather in space after all. But we don't have an environmental management system for Earth orbit. So I would look at my interest in the heritage value of space junk as part of a broader management system where if we are to get to the stage where we are able to actively remove pieces of debris, which we have to do, there's, you know, that you're right about that. There's no getting around that. It has to happen. But I would argue that not all pieces of space junk are equally junky. So there are some that have incredible amounts of historical and social and even sometimes spiritual significance for communities and individuals on Earth. And if we don't have to pull them out of orbit or destroy them, if they're providing a low risk, then, in fact, we have to do nothing. Now, of course, we're in an interesting period because the launch of the mega constellations means we may have to reassess what we consider as collision risk. So that's going to be interesting. But what I would like to see, there's a distinction between what people often talk about as preservation, which is the effort you put into keeping something and keeping it in a good condition for future generations, and management, which is more about balancing competing interests. So my perspective on this is simply I want to put heritage in as one of the competing interests so that if you're considering, so we know Astroscale have just launched the LCD spacecraft, which is like an all-in-one test bed to see that they've got a removal spacecraft and they've got a space junk analog and they're going to see if they can actually make that happen as a complete system. So it's very exciting. So I want them to succeed. I want this stuff to succeed. But in the future, I'd be saying, okay, let's assess the collision risks. Let's not automatically pull things out of orbit. Let's pull out the ones that, number one, are high risk and number two, have low heritage value.
Are you slowing down progress by asking those questions? Because, I mean, like, if you have to take care of every single piece of junk that's out there and take a look at it and call you up and ask you, is it okay if I throw it away or should I leave it here? I mean, like, what does that mean to human progress, technological progress?
Well, I think one thing is to make more progress in technology and space, we actually do have to understand the archaeological aspect of how materials decay, which is something we can contribute to. So asking research questions about the nature of space junk from an archaeological perspective can actually contribute to future design. So I don't think we're holding back anything in that regard. And I think in the future, like just like it is on Earth now. So, you know, in the beginning, mining was not a regulated activity on Earth and caused enormous environmental damage, you know, even more in the future. Now, there is no mine that would be initiated on Earth, a government-sanctioned one, which would not have to go through an environmental management processes. And that's just part of how it operates. So increasingly in the space world, like people are having to design their missions and their spacecraft with better end-of-life plans. So nobody's disputing that that needs to happen. So in terms of creating extra impediments to getting into space or to getting something out of space, I actually don't think this is going to make any difference. It's simply going to add a layer of justification. The other thing that's coming too, increasingly people are talking about space companies having to have a social license to operate in space. And these sorts of things are what the public is often incredibly interested in. So the ability to say, well, I have considered heritage as a factor and be able to talk about that with the public is more likely to gain a social license to operate than it is to impede it. So if you're looking at it in that whole context, then this stuff could actually become a very positive aspect of how missions are planned. Now, if spacecraft operators want to ring me up personally and say, Alice, will you write an environmental impact or a heritage impact statement or a cultural heritage management plan for our mission or our spacecraft, I will be very happy to do that. So that can only help their project. And fingers crossed, in the future, there will be far more space archaeologists who are available for this work. But I anticipate, you know, at some point, it might be just automatic that a space company will have an archaeologist or heritage specialist on their staff. So I'm putting the word out there to your listeners.
Sure. I think we have an incredible moment in time with an incredible chance to undo some of the mistakes we made as a society on Earth and to start anew in space by learning maybe for the first time in history from our mistakes in the past and by setting up new ways of social interaction and social behavior and environmental behavior because we have learned from our past. But do you see something like this going on, or are we also ignoring that moment in time as we're ignoring many other chances?
I think so many of us, you know, have exactly the dream that you've described, that chance to start anew, that chance to create a better world on another world. And I think it's part of what motivates and drives a lot of people in space. It's redemption in a way. But I would have to say also, yeah, I think we do run a big risk of repeating the mistakes of the past because we aren't paying attention to them. And, hey, look, we're no different to anyone else in history in that regard. Like, it's very sadly, it's a rare occasion when people, and we're seeing this right now in with the pandemic, like many places have not learned any lessons from the Spanish flu pandemic of 1918. So we're doing all the same wrong things again, plus new wrong things. So I guess it's how do we balance that optimism against that pessimism? And I suppose when I think about this, like I know our community, and you know this as well, like is so full of passionate people who want this to be a better future. And I think this is where I think someone like me and my colleagues who work in related areas do have a role to play because we can say, well, this is what we saw in the past. Here are our suggestions for how we do this better. And as we get more established and more heard, then our input into these decision-making processes can hopefully be greater. And I suppose like me being here now talking to you is sort of evidence that there is a greater capacity to have this kind of input. So I don't know. I'm never sure myself if I think we are going to succeed in, you know, this dream of having rectifying the mistakes of Earth in when we get to space. I'm not sure if we can do it. But what I'm doing my best to make sure that we do it, and you are too, and so many of us are. And I think that weight of optimism and goodwill and consciousness that this is not trivial stuff. These are huge things we're talking about, taking humanity off Earth. I think the weight of all of us trying to act for humanity to get us to a better place surely has to have a good outcome eventually.
Wonderful. Alice, I would like to go way beyond our earthly spheres. So let's go way beyond our solar system. The most distant spacecraft, human-made spacecraft at the moment, is one of the two Voyager probes, which left the Heliopause, that's the protective umbrella of our sun, more than almost 10 years ago. And now they're in interstellar space. What does that mean to you from an archaeological perspective?
Voyager 1 and 2, I mean, they're such extraordinary spacecraft. When I think about them with my archaeologist's hat on or my archaeologist's trowel in my hand, I think the first thing they tell us is the extent of human cultural influence. And it extends from the sun, where we have probes like, you know, the Parker Solar Probe, close-ish to the sun. In fact, I'm not sure where it is right now. I think it's doing more gravity assist swings around probably, but close to the sun. We have New Horizons, which is currently in the Kuiper Belt, and then we have Voyager 1 and 2, Pioneer 9 and 10, somewhere out there as well. The first thing it says is that human material culture extends throughout the entire solar system and into the galaxy. So that kind of, it's kind of an obvious thing to say, but if you think about it, that is extraordinary. It's absolutely extraordinary that in the sort of 80 years of the space age, we've actually had the capacity to send something out that far. I also think, because we still get signals from Voyager 1 and 2, so if you look at spacecraft like this as extensions of the human sensory world, I mean, most people would not be kind of tuning in to see what those signals are, but many of us in the space world, you know, we know when the antenna at Tidbinbilla is receiving signals. Some of us follow Voyager 2 on Twitter, so we know what's going on. So we actually have... This is something that starts to change the definition of what it means to be human, when we're actually incorporating space senses into how we feel or conceive of ourselves as located in space and time. Okay, probably a small portion of the population, but it still happens. So I think this is a very different state of being than if we, say, compared this to Neanderthal people living on the surface of the Earth. That says something about how humans have changed. And I think there's also, like, of course, the golden records on Voyager 1 and 2 are often talked about as if they're the most significant things on those spacecraft, and they are amazing artifacts, the golden records. But in a sense, they're the least important thing about those spacecraft. So I think there's also a sense of time involved in this, because they were launched in 1977. So their technology has not changed, while space technology on Earth has come a long, long way. So we kind of have an interesting time lag, which is something you don't have to deal with in terrestrial culture. The time lags we have, you know, are in the order of weeks or months or occasionally years. In this case, we've got 17 light minutes, light hours. I think it's 17 light hours they're away. Space has moved on so rapidly here, and they're still 1970s space technology. So that kind of I can't think of the word I quite want for this. So we're kind of looking at a
it's frozen in time.
It's so, yeah, it is frozen in time.
In space.
While everything else has moved on so quickly. And yet they're still functional. So this is an old technology that is still very much functional. So they say something about the resilience of this technology. And I think there'll be a time in the future where...
I'm deeply moved by the sheer thought that this thing is out there as we speak right now, alone in space right now, as is Philae, the Philae lander.
Yes.
On the comet. I mean, like... I'm deeply moved by that.
I cried so much about Philae. I think those emotional connections are important.
And it's still sitting there.
And I think how will we feel when we stop getting signals from Voyager 1 and 2 and they are truly orphaned all by themselves? I think how are we going to feel about that? And I think I'll feel very strongly about that. Like that's going to be a terrible moment when they no longer have the power to send signals back. And suddenly our universe will contract again. New Horizons will be the furthest object out there, and we'll have lost that limb, that hand that reaches into the broader galaxy, that where we can hear and see and apprehend. Like that will be gone.
We will sort of lose the connection, but still the object will be out there way beyond the span of humans on Earth. And even I think there is calculations that the Voyager spacecraft will be flying through space potentially even once the Earth ceases to exist. So, I mean, like, this is an absolutely mind-blowing thought to have a machine out there when the place of origin is not around anymore.
Oh my gosh, yes, that's like, they'll truly be our avatars in every sense of the word if they're all that's left of human civilization. That's like, oh, big stuff to think.
And then good luck, a space archaeologist trying to reconstruct where Voyager comes from.
Mm.
All right. You would have to reconstruct a solar system and a planet and then humanity.
Yes, based on so little. Yep, I hope someone will get to do it one day.
Alice, this is called Space Cafe Podcast. And now I would like to ask you if you are ready to share an espresso for the mind with us. That's a quick shot of inspiration from whatever topic you would like to choose that you might think could be particularly inspiring for our listeners. Are you ready?
I have a tiny piece of Skylab, just like a little tiny sliver of the insulation tank from Skylab, which, of course, people would know, re-entered in 1979 over Western Australia. And was given to me by someone who was in Los Angeles when parts of Skylab were taken over to prove that it really was Skylab. So I've got a verified lineage of this object. And to me it's incredibly precious because I can touch it and I know it's been in space. So it's a space-flown object. And it's just a little the tiniest bit of the insulation. But it makes me feel connected to space. It gives me the sense, it allows me to interact with space, you know, with my own hands and eyes. And I think this is what's so important about thinking about space heritage. It's not just saying, you know, here's some old stuff, let's see what we can find out about it. Space heritage is a critical part of how we feel ourselves connected to space through different objects and places. And I think this is really something, you know, if we want to carry the public along with us to support us in our space endeavors, things like this are ways to connect with people, to say bring something into their own house, into their own local environment. These things are already there, you know, space is all around us. I think heritage can be just such an important way of helping people feel connected to the cosmos. And for me, it's that little piece of Skylab that just kind of makes me, I don't know, have a slight shiver of a shiver of feeling that there's something broader out there and that we're, you know, nudging our way into it slowly, bit by bit.
Are we, is humanity an interplanetary species, or is that a pipe dream and should we rather stay on Earth where we belong?
Big question. I'm going to say it's time to lose the notion of species. It's time to stop thinking of humanity as a single object or a single entity, because it isn't. It isn't genetically and it isn't socially. So, and then thinking of, we let go of that and we think, let's think of the multiplanetary idea. Well, I want to recast that as multigravity. I think planets are irrelevant. So the critical part for whatever bodies we might be in, they might be amalgams of robotic and biological. Whatever bodies we're in as we move further, these little lumps of solid stuff, which we only have in the inner solar system and the far outer solar system, you know, maybe we're just a bit too fixated on them. Maybe we ought to be redefining what we think space and the solar system is to begin with. So maybe being a multiplanetary species is just like, it's one way to frame it, but it's not the only way. And I think we ought to be thinking of different ways before we get too fixated on this one.
Would you be ready to go now, today?
No, because I don't want to die early. So you can go, Marcus, but I'm not going.
Alice, thank you so much for taking the time. That was wonderful. Very inspiring.
I hope that was all right. I really do appreciate the opportunity to talk with you about these issues.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Marcus.
And thank you all out there for being here today. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Again, I'm the biggest fan of our wonderful guests myself. And if you like what we do here, maybe consider leaving us a review or two on your favorite streaming platform by hopping over to podcast.spacewatch.global. And P.S. Yes, we are always happy to receive feedback and suggestions. And you know what? I'm already looking forward to next time. Stay tuned and spread the word. See you then.